Mumbrella's CorbinsCon conference is returning on May 19, 2022, with a day of full content dedicated to the Australian communications industry. Held at the Four Seasons Hotel Sydney, this is your opportunity to dissect and discuss the pertinent issues on the local and international scene. Hear from Australia's executives and influential leaders on the big topics and gain insight on cutting-edge strategies. It's a day to network with your comms professional peers and keep your finger on the pulse of a rapidly evolving market. With a tumultuous year behind and the great unknown beyond, this is a day you cannot afford to miss. Purchase your early bird tickets now and save $100 for a limited time only. Head to mumbrella.com.au/commscon to redeem your savings.
Hello again, you're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. We are back. Thank you for joining us. I'm Damien Francis, and on the desk today for the third last time in 2021, breaking down Australia's media and marketing industry news, Mumbrella senior journalist Emma Shepherd.
Hello.
Reporter Anna McDonald.
Bonjour.
Wow, fancy.
Mix it up.
Very, very. And Mumbrella Cast producer and Melbourne editor-in-chief and lead reporter for Victoria, Callum Jaspin, MBE.
Hello. Thanks, Damo.
Anytime. I only speak facts. Later in the episode, I'll be talking to Nick Smith, Group Content Director at Medium Rare Content Agency, after his return to Australia, having held the position of Group CEO of fashion and lifestyle publisher Bureau Global, based in London. Prior to his time at Bureau, he was the Prestige and Lifestyle Director at News Corp Australia, and also formerly the editor of GQ Australia. In the conversation, we'll touch on the reasons why he left a CEO role to return to Australia.
And I just admired the way they work. We all just became a bit of a family. So it was a nice, not like I was parachuted back in, but it actually just happened out of the blue.
The challenges of running a publishing business across multiple markets.
We really took that sort of strategy of going into emerging luxury markets, where now you'll see actually Condé Nast have started to open up and go into those smaller ones. So we actually sort of created a footprint of, I think, about 12 million across the globe.
And becoming an employee of a business he was previously on the board of.
I know, I was on the board of Medium Rare, and now I'm actually working for Medium Rare.
It's meant to go the other way around.
Dawned on me. Thanks so much for that.
But before we let Nick Smith loose on the podcast, the news topics for today, please, Callum, Mr. Melbourne Bureau Chief.
So first up today, we're going to look at the Oztam TV figures for the year, with 9 and 7 duking it out in a fight for the most prominent TV network in Australia. And secondly, we have the federal government's new bill targeting anonymous online trolls and strengthening defamation laws, with a draft legislation dropping yesterday.
On Monday morning, Mumbrella reported that Seven had reclaimed the title of Australia's number one television network after being beaten out by Nine for two successive years, taking the highest audience share as well as the best growth of any network. According to Oztam data, Seven finished the 2021 ratings year with a 38.6% share of the commercial audience, ahead of Nine on 37.8% and Ten on 23.6%, with this year not including the Easter holidays and the Olympic Games in its counting. Seven's CEO James Warburton said it was great to be back at number one, but Nine were quick to point out that it wasn't ready to just lie down, with Nine's chief sales officer Michael Stevenson saying that Nine is number one again in the thing that matters most, the demographics that advertisers buy. Nine ranked number one for people 25 to 54, 16 to 39, and grocery shopper and child. Its primary channel was also number one with all key demographics, as well as the total people across the rating survey period. Seven and Nine have each claimed significant wins and are forecasting big years ahead, another Olympic year no less. We covered the general statements from all of the networks, but aside from throwing down and who won what else did they have to say about the relevance of the figures recorded, Em?
Yeah, it was definitely a fight between Seven and Nine. So congrats to Seven for actually winning the TV year. However, Nine was definitely vocal about, you know, being the number one in all key demos in both network and primary channel. Nine and Ten made it clear they're not really interested in total people figures and a lot more laser focused on key demos. Nine also said they were really surprised by some shows such as Love Island doing really well across both TV and digital, and said it was all about the total TV performance. You know, Nine also brought up with me media buyers want shows that kind of perform consistently throughout the year, which is also why I think they're focusing so much on their key demos as, you know, their strategy. And saying that, I think since Warburton has come back to Seven, he's definitely shifted his focus not just on total people, but also keeping an eye on those key demos as well. And if this continues, I feel like Seven definitely have a strong, you know, TV year in 2022. Ten's Prosser said in an interview with Cal that the network is really focusing on under 50s as a demo. However, Ten only had a 28.8% share in under 50s. What was also interesting to see was the figures next year with BVOD and SVOD on the rise as well. Stephen said that there was definitely a real growth in live streaming. He also mentioned that the 9Now app is growing at over 50% and growing at double rate of the on-demand growth too.
And that was, of course, Ten's sales director, Rod Prosser, you were mentioning just then, Em. None of this really means anything unless the networks are attracting buyers and money and investment, of course, and there's a reason why they're all throwing down and suggesting that they're number one in some way, shape or form. Cal, you spoke to a number of media owners. Are they buying the PR, if you will, from Seven on total audience, from Nine on the various demographics? From, I think this might be the first time Ten hasn't necessarily claimed a win, but obviously suggesting they've got some pretty strong demographics there. What was the industry sentiment from the buyers?
So I'll just run straight over that pun that you said there about them buying the PR, which you didn't even seem to acknowledge yourself. I did a bit of a rounds with a couple of buyers. I spoke to Janice Morgan from Magna, Nicola Barnes from iProspect, Steph O'Donnell from Cara Melbourne, and Bryce Cameron from PhD Australian, all group investment directors for their respective agencies. I think the general sentiment was that Seven taking the year was actually a little bit of a surprise. Also, a kind of general sentiment, and not so much a sentiment, but an acknowledgement that Seven started the year off not too quickly. So there definitely was a bit of a recovery in that second half of the year.
And even Warburton said that as well, that they had a slow start to the year.
Yeah, and you know, with Q1 programming such as Holy Moly and Ultimate Tag, Morgan from Magna saying not really living up to expectations, it wasn't really until the Olympics, which kind of provided linear and streaming audiences that really kind of got things going. And of course, you know, those Olympics weren't, as we mentioned before, included in the total streaming numbers, but it was of sorts a kind of platform to kind of leap off from, if you will. You know, they really timed things up well with SAS and The Voice coming off the back of that, with I think it being referred to as a sort of halo effect. Again, Morgan from Magna said that the unfortunate and unavoidable delay of the Australian Open at the start of the year on Nine, and subsequent pushback of Married at First Sight, which is one of Nine's kind of tempo programming, might have actually cost Nine pole position in total people. But unsurprisingly, Nine will be looking to focus on the demographic figures. Barnes from iProspect suggested that it's maybe time to start measuring the network's performance in a total viewing perspective across linear consolidated data and BVOD to give a true view on network performance. And of course, now we're kind of looking at those VOS figures, but maybe a move away from the actual the TV rating figures might be due at this point. In terms of 10, Barnes again from iProspect was saying that there's no denying that 10 struggled this year, although off the back of a strong uplift in 2020, they didn't actually manage to retain strong audiences. Despite that, they still managed to hold their year-on-year audience quite well against the core demos, which is, you know, as we spoke about there, 10 like to focus on being the under 50s network. Cameron from PhD Australia did say that Ten had consistent programming throughout the year, which proved to provide incremental audiences, which actually, you know, can differentiate themselves in the market.
I kind of see where Nine are coming from, though, in terms of really pushing the demographic wins, because realistically speaking, marketers are not necessarily buying. Well, they're not buying space on your network because you just happen to be number one across all audiences for the entire year. They want specific audiences. Did the numbers that we were seeing from the people you spoke to, Cal, did they change the views of any of those people necessarily in terms of where they're looking to invest next year, or was it pretty much we knew this was going to happen anyway?
You know, again, saying that the keeping in mind that the voice coming after the Olympics was what was referred to as the smartest player of the year, it was kind of the view also that focusing on the key demos, which is where the bulk of advertiser investment does lie, with shows like The Block, Lego Masters, having the NRL, Love Island, etc., on that kind of multi-platform approach, does have a specific demographic appeal and also creates opportunities for advertisers to align their brands specifically in those environments. So I think that is, as you say, kind of where the real money is, I guess. And then going into 2022, I think with this year, sport having been a big plus for Seven in that middle of the year, it's kind of being seen as that will be a big decider at the start of the year. So going into January, the Australian Open is going to be returning, and we can assume that Nine's going to use that to kind of kickstart a strong start to the year. And then you've got the Ashes on Seven.
And the Winter Olympics, no less.
Yeah. So, and then, of course, yeah, you've got the Winter Olympics and the Commonwealth Games, and then the World Cup at the end of the year on SBS, which will be one to look out for. The sentiment is that it's looking like Seven can really kind of keep hold of things and have a strong year next year, you know, with, as I mentioned, the Ashes, with the Voice Generations, a new kind of a new format there. So the prediction is that they will get off to a strong start, and there is a hope that they can kind of keep up a battle with MAPS as it continues to perform. But, you know, on 10, there's also stuff to look forward to. You've got the A-League kind of kicking off and kind of growing a bit of an audience, the Grand Prix returning as you'd probably hope, Damo, it's going to go ahead, and then a new MasterChef format coming in as well.
Yeah, I'm happy that's going to go ahead. I'm sure it will, but I'm not happy that we don't have it on free-to-air TV still. It'd be lovely if 10 could have that rather than having to do the subscription to see it. But nonetheless, we'll move straight on to that because it's not about me, Cal. It's about the audience. It's about
that's not what you say when we get off this podcast, Damo.
That's very true. Moving straight on. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the federal government and the moves it's making on social media giants. The federal government announced on Sunday that it would be introducing a bill to target anonymous online trolls and strengthen defamation laws in Australia. It would reverse the High Court of Australia's ruling from the Voller case that news outlets are liable for the comments made on their social media pages, as they are the publishers. The Attorney General, Michaela Cash, said that, quote, "The reforms will make clear that in defamation law, Australians who operate or maintain a social media page are not publishers of comments made by others," end quote. The proposed laws would put the onus back on the social media platforms and would require them to collect more information about their users, although it would still be possible for users to be anonymous on the front end of the platforms. Anna, the exposure draft of the bill was released yesterday evening. That was Wednesday evening. Feedback will now be collected, and the government insists that it would like to introduce the bill to Parliament early next year. Any new information coming out of that draft?
Yes, is the short answer. The long answer is when it was announced on Sunday, there are a lot of sort of unknowns. A lot of unknowns with the bill because obviously we haven't actually seen a draft of the bill. So the things that the draft legislation makes clear is, first of all, you're correct. The social, very clearly it states in the bill that social media pages, the comments underneath social media pages, the people that own the social media page, they will no longer be liable under no longer considered publishers, pardon, of those defamatory comments. And the main part of the bill, though, as well, it provides social media platforms are then the publishers of defamatory comments with a bunch of conditions. It establishes a defense for the social media platforms if they are found to be publishers of defamatory comments. One being the page owner must be Australian, so the actual social media page has to be Australian. Another being the comment, the alleged defamatory comment, has to be made in Australia, and the onus to prove that is on the defendant. So it's on
VPN. Anyway, go on.
Well, that's the thing. It's prior to the legislation being announced, Anthony Albanese came out and said, how will it be proven that these comments are being made in Australia? Everyone has access to VPNs. It's a global company operating in a domestic sphere. That's one of the issues with the bill. The second thing, in order to get this defense, all social media platforms have to have a complaint scheme compliant with the legislation. And also, in order to get it, this is a bit of a long one, apologies. So the applicant, so the person who the defamatory comment has been made against, so the applicant either has to have not requested the information through the complaint scheme or court or order, or have requested through the complaint scheme, this is the information for the anonymous person, have requested the information through the complaint scheme and the platform has given it, or the applicant has gone to the courts in order to get an end user information disclosure order. So in order to get the defense against publishing defamatory comments, that's what social media platforms have to do. The complaint scheme itself, which I just mentioned, there's a bunch of things. It's applicable to social media services with at least 250,000 Australia users or a service that is specified. There's a bunch of rules about what they have to disclose. Importantly, the platform has to respond within 72 hours. And it also removes liability for the disclosure of country location data and disclosure of contact details. And also there are fines if they don't comply. If the social media provider doesn't comply, it's $550,000 if they don't comply, with $27,750 for every day they refuse to comply.
So
that's a lot of
I'm just going to jump in there because, yeah, you're right. It's a lot of information. I think a lot of people, even reading some of the news articles that have come out about this, would have been quite confused quite early on. There are still a lot of questions up in the air about this in terms of it's still possible. It would still be possible to make a fake profile. You can put in a fake mobile number, and that's what a lot of this was hinging on, is that you'd have to provide name, address, phone number, even if your username didn't point to who you were. Anyone can bash in a fake mobile number or something like that. Quite easy to do. Also, though, the onus then being on the social platforms, they're not going to necessarily just say, yeah, that's a great idea. We're going to suck that one up. Anna, was there any comment from any of the platforms at this early stage?
Not yet. TikTok has declined to comment. I have reached out to a few of the other ones, but they've not yet gotten back to me. But so far, nothing from them on the bill. In The Guardian, Professor David Rolfe, who's a defamation expert at the University of Sydney, he said that the people that benefit the most from this bill are publishers. So it's good news for media outlets, pardon. Good news for media publications, media organizations. Not too sure how the social media platforms are going to respond.
Well, look, I guess we already know that Facebook isn't shy necessarily of pulling out of a country, particularly Australia. They've got history there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I still struggle with this one in terms of I'm not necessarily sure that it fixes a lot of issues in terms of what we've seen so far, or the challenges, which is, like we've said, VPN, you can get around the comment looking like it's been made in Australia. You can still provide false details if you really want to. No one's really talked too much about bots, if I'm not mistaken. ScoMo started saying a few things about bots here and there, but we know that a lot of those defamatory comments, those negative comments, those trolling comments are made by bots these days. So that's something that's still a big issue that they have to deal with. And again, here, you know, we talked about this with some of the other ACCC initiatives, the Digital Advertising Services Inquiry, for example. There's a long time frame here between actually coming up with the draft and then having a chat about it and then trying to bring it into Parliament and get it going. So it seems like we're still at the very start of the situation. Did you manage to speak to any publishers at all, Anna? This, you know, obviously they're going to say, hey, look, you know, we don't really want to be liable for this, but you would assume that they'll do everything they possibly can now to actually push it through as fast as they possibly can.
I would think, no, I have not spoken to any publishers, but what from what I've seen online when the announcement was made on Sunday, I think they're all pretty happy with it. Obviously, it's a bonus for media outlets because they don't have to then put the resources into moderating their comment section. It's one less thing that they have to worry about. I would be hesitant to say they'll be trying to push it through because I think to get involved between the government and big tech, I would think they would want to stay out of that one. It's not exactly an easy space to operate on. Lots of sort of powerful entities playing off of each other.
I think it's probably time we jumped off the anonymous topics and into the next topic for the Mumbrella Cast, because coming up next, I'll be speaking to Medium Rare's Nick Smith. So it's a pleasure to have Medium Rare Content Agency Group Content Director Nick Smith with me for the Mumbrella Cast. Nick, thank you so much for joining me.
No problem. Good to see you again after all these years.
Absolutely. And so a bit of background, I guess, for the audience. Nick, as the editor and then beyond at GQ, I was reporting into you as such as the consultant writer for technology.
You helped me out with all the stuff that I had no idea about. I could write about shoes and ties, but actually to talk tech, I needed you. So you were very valuable at that time. So
I appreciate
your work.
I appreciate it. Thank you. I wanted to write about shoes and ties at that stage. So I was looking to you to see what I needed to know about that. My fashion sense back then wasn't very good.
I don't let that information out. I don't really, you know, pass on the knowledge.
No, that's fair. That's why you got to where you got to. That's very fair. Nick, let me start with your current role. Announced in February this year that you'd be coming back to Australia, joining Medium Rare Content Agency. A little bit of a homecoming in the sense that back kind of in the News Corp family and at a business where you were on the board previously as well. What made you come back to Australia?
I know, I was on the board of Medium Rare and now I'm actually working for Medium Rare. I don't know.
It's about to go the other way around, isn't it?
That's just dawned on me. Thanks so much for that.
Sorry.
Yeah, look, obviously, you know, I had worked overseas for the last couple of years running sort of Bureau Global, which was like a luxury millennial digital-only platform, which was in 12 countries, which was quite interesting. Obviously, like a lot of Aussie expats, the pandemic brought me home. And look, I've always stayed in touch with Sally and Jerry, who've done a phenomenal job growing Medium Rare. So they'd always sort of, you know, kept the lines of communication open that if I did ever want to come home, there would be a place here. And look, hats off to them. I think, you know, in the early days, I think my role was when it was just Sally and Jerry and I think maybe the Coles magazine team, like I would help them go and pitch to new clients. So I think we sort of collaboratively worked on the David Jones content business, which started as like, I guess, a loyalty magazine and then Qantas. And I just admired the way they work. We almost became a bit of a family. So it was a nice, not like I was parachuted back in, but it actually just happened out of the blue. Paulette, who works in our creative, a rare creative agency within the agency, we met at F45 and she sort of said, do they know you're back? And I'm like, well, I'm trying to keep under the radar while I'm back in Australia. But then the next week I was in having lunch with Jerry and Sally, and I guess here I am.
Yeah, great. Look, and I'll circle back around to the work you're doing at Medium Rare.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, you were in Europe for almost 3 years, I think it was, at Bureau Global as the group CEO.
Yeah.
Kind of a rare thing to see an editorial-based person in a C-suite position. And I guess the interesting thing for me watching that was that you didn't come from a large market doing something smaller and then into a CEO position in a smaller market. You kind of went the other way around.
Yeah.
CEO position in a very large market. How did that all come about?
Well, so obviously within, I guess, the prestige division at News, and we had launched Bureau locally at that time. It's moved out of the portfolio since. But I think probably our launch here, and I guess growing up with, you know, the News way of doing things properly when you take them to market, I think was the most successful Bureau launch within the network. And there was about, I think, 9 bureaus around the world. So Singapore, Russia, Eastern Europe, Mexico, you name it. So I think we were probably one of the most successful launches where we very quickly established the positioning of Bureau. I'm not sure Bureau had sort of done that so successfully around the world, that, you know, really focusing on, I guess, the youth market, the growing trend of millennials and Gen Z to really get into luxury, and also the luxuries following them. So I think that probably impressed the owners of Bureau. They were obviously going through a process of trying to, I guess, move into more Western countries. So luckily I had a dual passport, and so they asked me to move the headquarters to the UK. So that was just, it was a bit of a risky thing to do, because obviously I hadn't worked in that market. Like, they could have been gone to someone at Condé Nast and set that up, but they chose me. So it was really an amazing experience in terms of that step up. You know, at News Corp, I'd been given amazing opportunities to lead a big team, and, but, you know, there's a lot of support there. So this was almost going from a big corporation to a smaller, more nimble one. So it was almost going to a startup. So, you know, anything from finding a space in London to rent, setting up all the back end, Wi-Fi, IT operations, and hiring the team from scratch. Amazing experience, tough as. So I think in that time we sort of had rebuilt the Bureau platform. We rebranded, so we made it more appealing to luxuries, and I guess a spread to the more Western countries, in line with, I guess, when you saw Burberry sort of do their big rebrand, or Balenciaga. We sort of, it was nice timing, so it was all a really great fit. We launched in the UK, and then I launched in other smaller markets which were emerging in terms of luxury. So Serbia, and we really took that sort of strategy of going into emerging luxury markets, where now you'll see actually Condé Nast have started to open up and go into those smaller ones. So we actually sort of created a footprint, I think about 12 million across the globe.
You did quite a bit when you were there. Like you said, you looked at other markets, you opened, moved the HQ to Soho in London, if I'm not mistaken. You hired some very key people as well. How did you find that shift from working in a similar industry in Australia, but then to a much bigger market, and actually running the entire operation itself?
Look, it was a challenge, and I say it was really tough. And look, I think I grew up as well. I think, you know, I think I probably had the best job in publishing in Australia, like looking after GQ, Vogue Living, and, you know, amazing brands such as Body and Soul, and launching Stella, plus having the support of News Corp behind, but then sort of taking that away and, you know, taking on, I guess, a challenger brand. So, you know, obviously luxury brands in the UK particularly are well established. So Vogue is Vogue.
Yep.
Harper's is Harper's. L is L. So, you know, really what I had to sort of do is, I guess, really, really position Bureau almost niche within that market to be able to get success. And I think I also had the backing of the founders to say, listen, if we're going to do this, we have to do it right. So I was able to bring on, I guess, a commercial director who had worked at Hearst and Condé Nast, and also Endemol Shine. I guess our licensing manager had come from Condé Nast. I got that real opportunity. And look, I was an unknown too. So I almost had to sell these amazing talent my vision for the brand to get them on board. We'd had, you know, our digital director had worked at Amazon and, you know, they took a risk on me. So, you know, when you move into that position, it's like, actually, God, I've actually got, you know, even though it was a small headquarters of about 10 or 11, like you've got, oh my gosh, I've got all these talented people who've come work for me. So there's that anxiety and that pressure of thinking, gosh, this has got to work, right? And we had a lot of fun doing it, though. I must admit, like, it was just incredible. Stressful ads, because we put timelines about, you know, when are we going to launch in the UK? We wanted to have, you know, certain openings. So I was going over to talk to publishers in, say, Paris or Italy to, you know, to start spreading the Bureau brand. But that was sort of 3 years in. And then the pandemic came and no one wanted to launch after that. So it was like, well, I've set up the structure. You know, it's in good hands and we've done the rebrand. So it was like, you know, it might be time to come home.
I was going to ask you about that, how the pandemic then shifted your focus and the business outlook. You know, things in Australia anyway sort of shut down quite quickly and then came back to life equally quickly almost.
Yeah.
How did you find it in Europe, particularly England? Very different situation.
Very different situation. And obviously, you know, we're almost a startup. Like, we weren't part of a bigger organization like a News Corp or a Condé Nast where they could probably, you know, let us go into, I guess, a cash flow deficit. Like, we were looking at cash flow daily, right? And so obviously running the headquarters, that was reliant on that luxury advertising coming in, particularly from the UK market, which, to be honest, I don't think, you know, many, a lot of sort of digital-only premium luxury brands had tried in the UK, but it failed because they'd gone to that approach of, okay, we have to do $100,000 fashion shoots and make it look like, you know, a magazine, but in digital. So we kind of worked out a way with sort of 3D animators and moving image and a dynamic platform that we could do that more effectively. So the business model was good that we could do luxury at speed and on digital, but we relied on advertisers. So we launched with Chanel, Dior, you name it, but as soon as the pandemic hit, right, in the UK, luxury is still very much bricks and mortar. So if the stores aren't open, they're not advertising. And obviously, you know, the last one in, so Bureau's a new launch, you know, in those kind of times, you know, I guess rightly so, media agencies and clients go back to the brands that they know, right? So we were trying to say, hey, yes, you still got to advertise with Vogue, because it gives you reach, but, you know, we are really engaged with the millennial audience and have different content too. So we were sort of saying, yeah, use us as an accompaniment, but in tough times, you kind of go understand that last one in is the first
last
one.
First
off the media schedule.
Sure. Now, in terms of the differences between the markets, Australia versus Europe, I guess, in terms of luxury and prestige brands, mm-hmm. Were there big differences that you noticed in terms of how they marketed, what they did, their consumer sets? What did you sort of take away from that?
I mean, listen, having experienced luxury over the last 10 years in Australia, like it's booming and it still is now, right? So I think when sort of I was running the luxury the prestige network at News Corp, you know, you'd speak to the CEOs of the luxury brands and they'd all be coming down here, right? And they'd say, you know, the luxury lights are on in Australia. But it was booming, obviously, because we had a large, Chinese tourist market here. But also Australians became more adept in investing in luxury themselves. So it was a win-win. So previously where I think probably, you know, luxury brands relied heavily on the tourist dollar, they'd increase, I guess, their base revenue from, you know, Aussies getting into luxury. So it was just booming. A little bit different, like the UK, it's really fragmented. Like you can't sort of say hey, there's a strong UK luxury shopper because it's so multicultural and also so transient. So in summer, you get a whole cohort from the Middle East over. And then it's a, you know, and then it's the other shoppers from, say, Asia, et cetera. So really hard to define the demographic there. And I guess that's probably, again, why we honed in on that youth market because, you know, luxury sneakers were going through the roof and, you know, creative directors like Virgil Abloh were joining Louis Vuitton. So it was that time where, you know, I guess Bureau represented that youth that youth market. So that's why we were able to get the brands in, even though they were struggling probably with their own demographics in store, because they couldn't really tell from one week to the next who was going to visit, say, Burberry in Shoreditch or Burberry in that high end of London. Obviously, you know, the proximity to the head offices was the big thing between here and Australia. And I think, I think if we ever have a pitch to a client here in Australia, it's like, okay, well, thank you, but now we've got to go through Singapore or Hong Kong, and then that goes to Milan and Paris. So the proximity to the actually head offices and the luxury to just actually walk in to the head offices of Hermes or Gucci, et cetera, and have conversations straight with, I guess, the people that were making the decisions was the big thing. So I think that was obviously amazing experience, and just to see inside those the worlds of luxury was just incredible. And I think probably because Europe is such an established market, they trust publishers to work with them a little bit more. So you can do more outrageous or more courageous promotions because you've got all the best talent at your hand. So often what I saw is a lot of the talent that was working for publishers were also working for the luxury brands doing their ad campaigns. So you're able to tap into a network of trust. And so the luxury brands, trusted, someone like Bureau to actually do something really quite innovative for them.
Yeah. Now, your role's pretty different now.
Yeah.
That you're back in Australia. It's more sort of content focused again.
Yeah,
exactly. Good to see you back in the content space more directly. For you working at Medium Rare now, what is the, I guess, the most important thing that Medium Rare and you and the team are sort of bringing to the brands, the clients that you work with right now?
Good point. So obviously, the reason I'm here is because the company has expanded so quickly. So I think we were saying at the beginning, maybe, Medium Rare has gone from a handful of employees to over 200, working with brands such as Qantas, Bunnings, Coles, Australian Institute of Company Directors, etc., Officeworks, amazing big retail brands who over the last 7 years have invested in content themselves. So I guess when we started Medium Rare, it was like we sort of had that sort of positioning or that vision to help brands become publishers. Now they are. They own their own audiences, their own social channels, their own YouTubes, they're doing podcasts. So my role is really to keep that innovation of content being delivered to clients. So I guess at the moment, we're looking at the TikTok platform. So in Australia, that's got sort of legitimacy in terms of the audience, but also brands are sort of validated by sort of activating on there. So our role is really to drive content that delivers results. So we've got a lot of big retail clients like Officeworks and Coles, so it has to move product. So we've got to make sure that content, whether it's in print or digital, etc., does that. And I think, Medium Rare's positioning is that our content, I guess, is probably the most insightful content. So yes, there's that ability to be creative in there, but really we root everything in insight. So before we even write a story, whether that's in print or digital, we do the SEO insights. We look at macro trends across the globe and locally to see what the consumer mindset should be at a particular time. And then I think what we do is we help clients be able to deliver on their business objectives. So if I look at Coles, for example, in any one month, they've got so many messages to tell their consumers. Yes, it's to move, I guess, Christmas food, but then there's also the sustainability message. There's the community message. There might be a promotion that they've got to talk about as well. So it's so complex now, and there's only a finite amount of channels that they can actually talk to their consumers. So part of our work really every month is not just the end result of the content, it's that strategy and saying, when are we going to talk to the consumer about this topic and how are we going to talk about it and what format? So, the beautiful thing that I've seen at Medium Rare is that content is really now, I guess, front and center. So, when we're in a meeting with one of our clients, the ad agency will be there, the media agency will be there, the PR agency will be there. So content has really got a seat at the table, and it's very important in the mix. So for me, I guess it's here, now that the business has grown to such an extent, I'm here to actually drive innovation for our existing clients, then obviously there's a ticket on my head. I've got to find new clients as well.
No pressure.
No pressure.
Speaking of pressure, though, you brought up some very interesting points just then about communicating with consumers and you're advising essentially and producing on behalf of your clients, obviously with them and the other agency partners involved. But part of what we've seen over the last 18 months through the pandemic is that a shift in consumer behavior, in consumer spend, which in Australia is still in most sectors quite strong, but the way we've done it has shifted. What have your biggest takeouts been? What are you advising your clients to do now and to change because of that?
Yeah, and I think when I started, we sort of went into market to actually find out, you know, what are consumers or what are Australians thinking about brands doing content? I think it was well known that content played a role in that consideration phase. So, you know, when a consumer discovers a brand or service or product, you know, they take some time evaluating and looking through the market and doing that comparison. We went into market and actually found out that content is playing a bigger role because of these macro trends that have sort of accelerated during COVID. So, you know, at one end, you've got the binge economy. So someone can spend all weekend looking at a device but not really seeing an ad. And then, you know, there's that sort of age of antitrust that, you know, there's sort of this distrust in government and institutions. So consumers looking to brands for information, or they're going underground to seek their information. Then there's obviously the new novelties like TikTok, like Instagram. They're content platforms. So in some respects, content or the demand for content is due through these macro trends. And so when you understand that and you go a bit deep and you ask the consumer, you know, about content, and they can specifically say, oh, I go to Priceline for this, I know Coles does that, and I love Woolies recipes, it's like my mum and dad. They're really using content in all the way through their purchase journey or their experience with the brand. So awareness is now as important as advertising, I think. Content plays a really important role in awareness, as does advertising. And then all the way through, what we're sort of seeing, particularly for those big retail brands, if you're doing it really well, consistently, and it's premium, you can lock your consumer into your ecosystem. So obviously when price and promotion and retail is so competitive, you've got a really compelling content ecosystem that draws people in, helps them go speedily through that consideration process. You're going to get them to buy or like or follow you, but then they'll keep going by, I guess, looking forward to your content. So really, I guess what we're, you know, part of my role is also to educate new clients and also clients that have invested in it over the last 4 years to go, actually, this is the power of what you're doing. So you may not be there yet. You may not have the scale of, say, an Officeworks or a Coles or a Qantas. You know, they've been doing it for many years. But if you start by growing your own audiences, because I think it's something that I learned at Vogue and GQ, you know, when you grow your own audiences on social and digital, you can then mobilize your audiences to do something. And that's why we were so successful with, say, Vogue Fashion's Night Out or GQ Men of the Year, because we could rally our troops to actually go and do something for us. So that's, I guess, using my experience in consumer to talk to clients to go, listen, the most important thing of the content is that you're growing your own audience and your engaged audience, and you can get your consumers to go and do something.
Yeah, 100%. And like you said before, you're doing your own research, Medium Rare is doing the same research, but you know, I assume in this age of first party data, big data and big tech platforms, there's probably a lot that the brands can, you know, show you as well that you can start to digest. How important is that in the relationship?
Really, really important. And I think, you know, in some respects, what we've had to move from being sort of that service that will help you become a publisher is really become like an extension of your marketing department. So in that respect, we've actually leaned in more in terms of those old school things, which I'm good at, is like driving relationships, you know, finding out who in organizations has the knowledge, and collaborating more with clients. So it's less of a service now, it's more of a collaboration. So, you know, the insights that we can get from the client, whether it's anecdotal, whether it's from their CRM, or whether it's from their, you know, customer service team to their data, is what helps us do a better job.
And is it easy to get that, or is it more fragmented now? One of the things we keep following is who owns what information and how do we get it and how do brands actually digest it, because there is so much going on.
Yeah.
How do you find that working with clients? Is it, you know, are you using, are you leveraging your ability to go to everyone?
There's probably some more work to do. And you know, when you're starting to work with big organizations, there's so many departments internally. I mean, any media or advertising agency would know that. So it's the same for us. You know, the good thing is with most of our clients, we do have, I guess, either a marketing team or a content team to go to, so they can be our funnel to get more information from the rest of the organization. But listen, it's a slow build to get to that sort of utopia of having full access to all the data. So, you know, and also, you know, technology needs to be implemented, like, you know, AI or personalization in content. It's not there for a lot of brands yet, but it will be. So we're starting to talk to a few brands about that. So I guess, you know, having a more of a partnership or a collaboration with brands that we can either test and learn, and a lot of brands are open to that now, or we can be their partner on the journey to that, as I say, utopia of getting to understand, you know, the good thing about data at the moment, the way we use it, is we can be informed pretty much, you know, the content that worked last year is, you know, the same that's going to be searched for this year. What we probably can't tell is, I guess, you know, what they're wanting to search tomorrow, right? You know what I mean?
How dare you not be able to tell the future?
Love to be able to, but that's where we need tech to help us.
So let's actually stay on the future discussion at the moment in terms of, you mentioned getting the seat at the table previously, which is good to hear.
Yeah.
Also, though, it throws up some interesting questions. And again, it's something that Umbrella's been following for quite a while in terms of the old boundaries, if you will, of creative agencies, media buyers, PR agencies are sort of dissolving and each are kind of spreading their wings into each other's, you know, what was traditionally each other's business. Yeah. Now, medium rare, you know, as we were sort of speaking about before we started recording it, traditionally you're going, oh, medium rare, aren't they just like a content marketing business? Yeah. And it's not really that anymore. Mm. It's a lot more than that. Yeah. How do you find that relationship with other agencies and where, I guess, your work starts and stops and theirs starts and stops? Yeah. How does that work?
Look, the lines are blurring, definitely. And, you know, if I look at ad agencies, you know, they're launching content divisions. We're trying to move more into that creative territory. So I think probably something that the team and I worked on this year with Jerry and Sally is like, let's move to an agency response sort of model. So as I mentioned before, we're replying to campaign briefs, etc., via content. But then if you look at the work we're doing for David Jones, you know, Justine and the team are almost setting like a creative vision each season for David Jones, and that creative vision or territory gets taken above the line or into window displays or in-store experiential kind of activations, and we're okay with that. You know, I don't mind encroaching. I guess, you know, I'm going to probably get more and more people coming to do content because, you know, brands are wanting it. So I guess we just need to be, we're cognizant of that. And listen, again, with our clients, we're really saying, listen, we'll not only collaborate with you, but we'll collaborate with the other agencies as well. And listen, the clients are demanding that as well. So clients are saying, listen, you guys work it out, right? There is a place for content within a part of a campaign, maybe not for everything. You know, sometimes if there's a new message, say around sustainability, that needs a big broadcast campaign, which is an above the line TVC, et cetera. You know, people starting to search that for content, but you're really going to need an above-the-line campaign to really land that message. We can start doing, you know, ongoing, always-on community stories and sort of seeding what brands are doing in that territory, but you're going to have to work hand-in-hand with above-the-line. So we actually now, for a lot of brands, really ask our clients to say, listen, we're happy to have, you know, weekly whips or collaborations with the other agencies because it makes the job easier for the client.
Now, I'll finish on two things, but I have to sneak this in because of all the talk about the great resignation and all that sort of nonsense, which I've made my points of view quite clear on in the Best of the Week email, but it's not about me. It's about you for this podcast. Nick, you mentioned the expansion of medium rare and going into different areas as well.
Yeah.
How hard is it for you guys at the moment to hire not just content, but potentially other areas which you might not be as well known for yes. right now?
Yeah. listen, I think every agency is now, I think they're now open to the fact that actually the employee is leading what the engagement is. So, you know, medium res, you know, we've moved into this new, beautiful, sustainable office in Piedmont next to Publicis. We've moved to flexible working arrangements. So, you know, you can work 3 days in the office and 2 days at home, as long as that's approved.
You actually just get lost on the Publicis level and have a bit of a sneak around.
Yes. and you know, this day, you know, that's what, you know, people have lived 2 years within this pandemic, or I know I have, where it's like, well, listen, you've got to work with the talent, and you've got to keep them comfortable. And you know, people in this now, you know, want to stay at home because it's like an hour less travel. And there's those kind of things where in the past I would have probably gone myself. It's like, no, I want my people here. I want them all on the floor. I like to walk the floor and have that communication. But it's like, well, that's me. It's not the staff. So if they feel more supported, or have more choice within the way they want to work, or so be it. And listen, we've started to, you know, hire remote people. So we, you know, we've got a sound designer who's in Byron Bay. You know, our podcast producer has just moved to Adelaide. So you know, you can do our sort of work from wherever. And especially as we expand more around the country and to say New Zealand or even Singapore, we're going to have I guess, a global workforce. And I think that's something I learned from Bureau long before the pandemic. I was doing Zoom calls with the team in Singapore and then Serbia and at weird times. So I kind of had adjusted to that way of working more globally. And so I think it's only a good thing, really.
And I promise this is the last question, and I'll leave you on this, but having Group CEO on your CV is a pretty impressive title, and I think some may say a little bit. You get to get used to it, in a sense. You get used to that, in a sense. So,
is this question about me having to roll up my sleeves?
Not at all. I see you have rolled up your sleeves. Literally, you are ready for the work. But will we ever see you again, maybe in a CEO type role? Have you closed the door on that, or is it still open in the future?
Listen, I'd definitely love that.
I noticed Medium Red doesn't have a CEO. Oh. At the moment. Just something I noticed.
But, nothing to talk about there. No. Yeah, obviously, look, one day that would be amazing, right? Look, it gave me a fantastic experience. You know, at the end of the day, you also do have the weight of the whole entire organization and the shareholders on your shoulders when you do that. So, you know, this role has been quite fantastic and a gift, because I've begun to sort of come back to Australia, almost, you know, get back into that same tribe that I was before, in terms of, you know, working with talented people. I'm really happy driving, I guess, innovation in the content division of Medium Rare, and we're growing. So, you know, I'm pretty busy at the moment. That's a diplomatic answer.
Good answer. Very diplomatic. Well done. Group Content Director for Medium Rare Content Agency, Nick Smith. Thank you so much for joining me on the Mumbrella Cast.
Thanks, Damien. Big break.
And that's a wrap for this week. Please make sure you subscribe to the Mumbrella Cast on whatever your favourite podcast platform happens to be. Emma, Callum, Anna, thank you so much for joining us again on the Mumbrella Cast.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.